accession number 18468, reel 3.
Jack Clegg, reel 3.
If the world goes, we all go. From on closing the beach, there'd been the usual preliminary bombardment, and the Air Force had dropped whatever they were dropping on, and the beach itself, or where we were going to land, providing the Navy put us in the right place, which didn't happen very often, unfortunately. The beach itself is obscured by the amount of smoke that's been from the previous explosions. As the craft nears the beach, one can see all sorts of underwater things that are sticking in the water that with explosives hanging on them, and one knows you've got to avoid all these before you can even get on the beach. What you can't see is what's under the water. So as the craft grounds on the sand and the ramp goes down, then the butterflies start. The tension in the tummy, you know, once heard of you tying your stomach in knots, it really does. You know that whoever's on the other side of that beach is going to try and kill you. In the tank itself, you're fully waterproofed. The only one that can see anything is the tank commander. He gives his instructions to the driver through his throat microphone and to the gun layer. The gun is not going to be fired on the run-in because you'll be underwater anyway most of the time. The ramp goes down. The engines have already been warmed. And off you go. All sorts of odd noises are coming through your headphones. You can hear possibly bullets splashing against the side of the landing craft and your tank. Pit, 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 you know, and, that you ignore. Your sole object now is to get through the water and on the beach. Whatever angle you come off the tank landing craft is the angle that you'll steer through the water until you get out of the water line. Otherwise, if one tries to turn the tank in water, it's possible you'll take a track off. So whatever angle we come off at the thing, that's where we're going for the next 2 or 3 minutes, which seems an age, until such times as we're on the beach. Now we're on the beach, everything is, you press the switch to drop your reserve ammunition off. You blow some of the waterproofing off the rear. This is all done by explosive bolts. And they give you a tank, a better breathing space. And now, all that you've learnt in the months previously is brought into being. You know where your targets are. If you're in the right place, you know exactly where your targets are. And you're already looking for places that you can identify. So once you're identified somewhere, you just carry on there, doing a job that you've trained for years, and this is your revenge for Norway. crossing the beach, we know that on the other side of the high water mark, there's a large minefield, and we're hoping that our friends in the AVREs, which are known as the Funnies, who are the operators of the flail tanks and all the many other fancy things that they carried, the bridging equipment and all that, but the flail tanks were the ones I wanted to follow, as he was going to go straight through the minefield and get us onto what was a secondary road. Unfortunately, the flail tank only travels at 1 mile an hour, which isn't very fast. And although we'd taken out all the things in our immediate vicinity, from the bottom end of the beach, which was out of our range, there was a German 88mm in a firing enfilade along the beach, not out to sea, which was taking a terrible toll of our armoured vehicles. And there's absolutely nothing we could do about it. We couldn't. It was way out of our range, and even so, our guns wouldn't take on anything that was in an emplacement, as they would only penetrate very minor armament. Eventually, I think he was taken out by the infantry, but he'd done enormous damage on that beach before he was killed. The weapon of the war, in our opinion, was the German 88mm gun. It could outrange anything we had in the anti-tank line, and originally it had been designed as an anti-aircraft weapon, very similar to our own 3.7 anti-aircraft, which we had never bothered to develop as an anti-tank weapon. The nearest thing we got to that was our 17-pounder, which was about our most effective weapon, but we had so few of them. We cleared the beaches sufficiently to enable landings to go ahead by approximately 10 o'clock in the morning, which was a very good going for what our estimates had been. Our casualties had been estimated, we had been told, unofficially, that our casualties would be 80%. Which is one reason why you can see that none of us were very keen to go. Fortunately, we got away lighter than that. And we cleared the beach and watched our leading infantry and armoured vehicles start coming ashore, knowing that we'd done our job. And officially, our job was to crack the beach and nothing else. However, things never work out to plan, and due to the storms in the channel and the inability to get lots of people ashore, we had to remain there. On D-Day night, we went into what we called our SOS targets. That was taking on anything that anybody asked us to take on, providing we had the ammunition, of course. And we fired a large number of rounds and had the fortune to witness one of our shells landing in a German ammunition dump, which was quite spectacular. During the night, lots of various units came ashore and passed through us and on towards wherever they were going. And in the following morning, I was chatting with one of the drivers of a Churchill flamethrower, a crocodile as they call them, and he said, have you been down to your right at all? I said, not really, no, why? He said, there's something in there, you know. I haven't been down, I haven't. He said, there's something heavy in there. It's not on the map. We decided between us, him with the flamethrower and me with a 95mm, to go and have a look. Having a look with a blast from one blast from a flamethrower and one shell from a 95mm, we captured a German battery, which there was no indication on the map ever existed. There were 250 Germans who had sat behind us all night, and they fired one round the following morning, and that was their undoing. And we felt quite pleased with ourselves at that. The rest of our time in Normandy consisted of joining in various bombardments, taking on any targets, and generally messing about until such times as they said, well, now you can go home. By which time there was so much artillery on the ground that they didn't need us anymore. The only snag was that every time the artillery opened up, the Germans had already pre-ranged most of the targets, and whenever anybody opened up, you were promptly bombarded back, sort of thing, within 20, 30 yards all the time. So we left our vehicles, tanks, at a small place called Jerusalem, which I thought was a appropriate name for anywhere in France, and returned to England.
When you captured the German prisoners, what was their manner?
Glad to be out of it, I think. The German division that faced us on Gold Beach was a mixture, it sounds odd. The first live German I captured was a Russian. And it was a composite division. It made of Russians, Ukrainians and French, Polish, all sorts of people who had been more or less pressed into the German army. They weren't much of a knot. I think they were quite happy to be captured. I mean, we didn't even send guards with them when we said, you know, the way to the beach is there. March down there and somebody will take you over. We couldn't spare any of our men to go with them. So we just pointed them to the beach and said, march down there. And the whole lot marched down there. But previous to leaving there, before we left, I was in close proximity to the Canadians who were on our left. The Canadian divisions were on the left of us. And they came up against one of the Hitler Youth divisions, German SS. And that was when we met the first atrocities of the war, as far as we were concerned. The Germans had captured the Canadians and had hung them up with piano wire and shot them in the back of the head.
Did you see this?
Yes.
What did you see?
What did I think?
What did you see?
Did they think?
What did you see?
The Germans had hung these from a tree on piano wire. And we learnt later that they tried to interrogate them. And they were Hitler Youth. Some of them were no more than 16, 17 year old. And that...
Where did you see this?
This was just near Tilly-sur-Soldre, I think it's called. Then.
How many Canadians did you see?
There's three. But they say there were more, but I mean, I didn't see those.
So what did you do?
Well, I knew that the Canadians were not taking prisoners that day. I wasn't taking any prisoners at all because I wasn't involved in capturing any, so I don't know. But I think at the time when you see these things, You say, well, the next German I see, I'm going to shoot. I mean,
but you did capture all those Germans in the battery.
That was before. That was previous. That was in D plus one. This was getting on for about ten days later, I would think. No. No, it's when you see atrocities committed like that, it turns you against the nation forever, whatever they might think. I mean, I've never forgiven Germany. I can't. Not just because of that, but subsequently when one learnt of the horrors of Belsen. I mean, I've just been to the funeral of one of the people who went to Belsen when it was first released and has never, it's lived in his mind ever since. And he wasn't even in the fighting forces, he was in the Air Force. But he was sent to Belsen. And that poor son has never forgotten it for one day. And then, of course, we, after Normandy, we thought our war was over, but we were mistaken. It promptly sent out to the Far East.
Is this still the same unit?
Well, we changed our names. It was quite, the personnel were more or less the same.
But what was the unit called in Normandy?
It was the Royal Marine Armoured Support Regiment. I have a complete list there of all the forces.
And what did you become afterwards then?
After that, we went out to the Far East and we became the Royal Marine Amphibious Assault Unit. Only this time we were using American equipment.
Support unit, you were called, the amphibious support unit.
Amphibious assault unit. We changed from support to assault.
So in Normandy, if I can get this straight, it was the Royal Marine Armoured Support Regiment.
That's right.
And then you became the Royal Marine Amphibious Assault Unit.
That's right.
Whereabouts in the Far East was this?
Well, we originally started in Bombay, and then we equipped there with the American amphibious tanks, the Amtraks as they called them, and they were equipped with 75mm guns, rocket projectors, and flamethrowers. The flamethrowers we developed ourselves, as we didn't like the way they fitted their own. We always thought that to ignite the jellied petrol as it left the nozzle was not the way, most efficient way of using it. We ignited the jellied petrol at the end of its flight, so that all the jelly petrol arrived on the target before it was ignited. Callous, but workable. We formed, we trained in various places in India, Kalakwasla Dam and all over, just outside Pune. And we're then being formed up for the re-invasion of Malaya first. The first attack was to be put in at Port Swettenham, north of Singapore. It had been estimated that to take Japan out of the war by land means and assaults would cost ourselves and the Americans 2 million casualties. As one had already found out that the Japanese did not surrender. And the only way to get the Japanese out of anywhere was to kill him. Not even wound him, because even the wounded Japanese were just as dangerous as a lion. Fortunately, well, I say fortunately, the atom bomb was used. And I think the general feeling amongst the assault troops and troops that were going to have to make this journey back to Japan was, let's drop another one. And they did. This officially brought the end of the war. Unofficially, the war carried on in quite a number of places. After a pause of a couple of days, it was decided that we would go to Batavia, calling at Singapore on the way, to try and see what the situation was regarding prisoners of war and internees, as they call their RAPWE, as it was called in those days. So we left around most of our heavy equipment and went calling at Singapore, and left a detachment there to assist in the release of the prisoners of war. And I carried on to Java, as it was then, to Bandung, which is the capital, to find a scene of what can only describe as utter chaos. The Japanese had passed over quite a lot of their arms to the local Indonesians. The Dutch wanted the Dutch East Indies back, but had no means of doing anything about it. So we were given the job of trying to bring some sort of order at the same time as sorting out our prisoner of war and internee problems. And there was no police force. Everywhere was a state of civil disorder. The Indonesians wanted the country to themselves. I call them Indonesians because that's what the country became eventually. They'd been armed by the Japanese. We were not concerned with a fight as a colonial power. I mean, it wasn't our job to give Indonesia back to the Dutch and anywhere else. We'd already decided that India was to be given back to the Indians. So we couldn't really see why it was our job to fight the Dutch's war in a conflict that was of no interest to us whatsoever. Plus the fact that we had a considerable number of hostility-only people in our unit, whose only object now that the war was over was to get demobbed and get back home. And didn't see why they were going to get killed doing this for somebody else. Once the prisoner of war position was, all our prisoners were out of the Dutch East Indies as far as we could ascertain, and most of the Dutch internees had been released, we were withdrawn from the Dutch East Indies, called in a little further along the coast at Borneo. I'm going to say a little further, about another 1,000 miles at Borneo, and found the situation was reasonably stable out there, and apart from the odd Japanese who wouldn't give up, and the only thing to do was to kill them, and not the end of story. Once the Dutch were cleared, and we'd been to Borneo, and as I say, we had the problem with the odd Japanese who, whether or not had been told to surrender, they hadn't been told by the Emperor to surrender, and as such, they didn't believe it, and as I say, they were quite prepared to open fire on you. So life at the time was a very risky business. In fact, one could say it was a comical situation. We had at times to use Japanese troops as sentries because we had had not enough of our own troops to take part. This was in Indonesia.
In Java. Had you had to open fire yourself in Java?
Oh, yes. We were fired on practically every night by various people. We never knew who. So it was decided that whoever fired at us would be fired back, and end of story. When we found the bodies, probably the next morning, very often they turned out to be local Indonesians, odd Japanese, and even the people that were back in the Dutch. It's a situation that one doesn't want to be mixed up in, because you never know if the next person coming down the road is going to throw a grenade at you or say hello.
So were you just returning fire against rifle flashes or something?
Machine guns and things like that, rhetoric guns. They had whatever the Japanese had given them, and the Japanese had just more or less put their arms in a pile and said, help yourself. And there was quite a resistance movement with building in the Dutch East Indies. So
did that happen very often when you had to return fire against...
Oh, every night. Every night, you could say, you had to return fire. But you never knew who you were firing at.
And you were in a camp when they were...
Oh, no, we were living on a jetty amongst a blooming old heap of rusted iron at the time. We had no camps at all. We could make our area around the docks secure. Had we gone into a town, you'd leave yourself open.
So this was at Bandung?
This is Bandung.
Did you move off the jetty much?
Only to find out what was going on. We went into the town. During daylight, we had no problems. Nobody's going to stand up and fire at us in daylight. We knew very well that we would... probably too far too experienced for that. But at night, you see, you've got a huge area, you can't possibly make everything secure. And the docks themselves, that stage, were piled high with about 1 million tons of sugar, which was oozing out from, piled about 50 bales high, 100 weight bags, oozing out. There was a complete field ambulance, complete field dressing station piled on the jetty, which had been there since 1940, which the Japanese would not allow the internees to use, full of dressings and everything that people had been crying out for in the Far East, drugs and all that. A complete American field hospital dumped on the jetty and had lain there since 1940, while people had died in thousands from lack of drugs and everything else.
And yet you found in Borneo things were different from Java.
The more out in Java,